It's a great privilege indeed to be with you. Many of you, I'm sure, heard the concert last night. I have never heard such a heart-crushing rendition of Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child, and I'm sure several of you felt the same.
I hope you don't divorce what we're talking about at lunch bars from that sort of deep emotion. For example, I mentioned Muggeridge. When he was about to drown, and wanted to, and saw those lights, what turned him round was an incredible sense there might be home if there was meaning in the universe. I mentioned Bertrand Russell. Russell had such an incredible logical, mathematical mind, with such incisive judgments, his friends called him the Day of Judgment. But his lovers, and he had many mistresses, said that when they made love to Bertrand Russell, it was nothing like that. Because down beneath was a raging loneliness that poured itself out into making love and was the deepest drive for his sense of meaning in life. So we're talking about something not just purely intellectual, because we are whole people. Minds, yes, thank God for the Oxfords and Cambridges. But we've got emotions and wills and so on. And think of yourself as a whole person engaged in searching for the meaning of life. Today, though, let me move the discussion along. Yesterday, a time for questions, which is what constitutes a seeker. Today, logically, a time for answers. That sounds very easy. But, of course, when we come to answers, you come also to the issue I want to tackle today. With so many religions, philosophies of life, and worldviews, how can anybody choose? Now, that, of course, is made worse today. It's not just a matter of, there are a whole lot, how do I choose? But in our world, and particularly in campuses, they're all surrounded with controversies. And so I want to deal with that in the few minutes I have. First, let me outline a cluster of some of the main objections to the fact of even considering worldviews, philosophies of life, and religions. There are basically three that come up again and again over the last 50 years. First, all the religions are true in their way, and probably all equally good. Very typical of the 1950s, and any generation that's seeking consensus and doesn't want to be offensive to anyone else. And you still have people like that today. All equally true in their own way. Second objection, much more typical of our day, they're all equally false and all extremely bad. They're divisive. They're arrogant, they're exclusive, and they're profoundly dangerous. How Religion Poisons Everything, the subtitle of Christopher Hitchens and dear old Richard Dawkins' constant lament. And then the third criticism, they're all reactionary and they're disappearing as the world progresses and gets more modern. Let me deal with those in reverse order. That idea that religion is disappearing is itself disappearing. It's what's known as the secularization theory. And it was held for 200 years under the influence of great thinkers like Kant and Max Weber. The idea is the modern world gets more modern, we get less religious. So Europe was the vanguard of the world, the least religious continent in the world, and somehow the United States, long considered a little bit of an exception, the most modern country, but also, strangely, the most religious of modern countries. That has collapsed, that theory. On the one hand, it's self-serving. It was put out by people who were secularist, who wanted religion to disappear, and they built in their assumptions into the theory. But more importantly, it is factually plain nonsense. Ever since the Iranian Revolution, anyone looking at our global era, you can see we are seeing an explosion, a resurgence of religion. In the world today, religion is a furiously alive and well, as one scholar puts it. Now, there are two exceptions. One exception is geographical, Europe. for historical reasons and the major revulsion against Europe, against the religion in Europe, is a revulsion against the excesses and evils of the state churches in the past. The other exception is social. Many of the educated elites around the world, and there you can still see the spillover of the effects of the Enlightenment and also today postmodernism. But the idea that religion is disappearing is utterly nonsensical. How about the second objection? They're all equally decisively bad and should be dismissed in various ways. They're nonsense, they're bad faith, they're a projection. You pick your objection. Today it's understood that every one of those types of skepticism can be applied to themselves, and in many ways they apply more to those who are the critics than they do to what they're criticizing. I was at Oxford with the great philosopher A.J. Eyre. And I remember talking to him on the train one day when he was in his late 70s. A.J. Eyre was famous for the verification principle. You only accepted as true that which could be verified through the senses, the five senses. So he said famously, the word D-O-G, dog, is more meaningful than the word G-O-D, God. The dog can be verified through your senses, touch, smell, all sorts of things. God can't. His theory, which came down like a guillotine on religion, collapsed when someone said, the emperor has no clothes. Why don't we apply the theory to itself? AJ's own principle couldn't be shown to be true by its own standards. And when I met him those years later, when he was in his late 70s, he said to me, with a rueful smile, every great skeptic should be forced to wield his debunking sword over his own theories in public. And he admitted his couldn't be. Now, you've all heard religion is a crutch for the fatherless and all this sort of stuff. All the recent studies have shown there's a link between atheism psychologically and absent or weak or bad fathers. Take, say, Nietzsche, whose father died when he was a small boy. Take, say, Bertrand Russell, who was orphaned very early. Actually, all the studies have shown that what they criticize religion for, when applied to themselves, even more devastating. How about the third objection? They're all roughly true in their own particular way. Well, that sounds good in theory, and it sounds very benevolent to be able to say so. But you can't say that when you've actually looked at all the different worldviews. You could take even faiths that are very, very similar. Take, say, the three Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, the Christian faith, and Islam. If Jews and Muslims are right, Christians are wrong. And if Christians are right about who Jesus claimed to be, Muslims and Jews are not right. You can't have it both ways. There's a very clear choice to be made. And there are huge differences, even between faiths that are very similar. Now, when you come to faiths that are not similar, you have even much bigger differences. In other words, many of these surface objections, if you look at them carefully, disappear. But they leave us with the grand task. There is nothing left to do but a careful, patient examination of the different answers that are given us. Now, the simple fact is, we know we can't find answers through science and technology alone. More and more they deal with the how of things, not the why of things. You move up, can we look to the arts? Well, modern art is increasingly elitist, and in some cases nihilistic, and most of the great artists admit they don't have the great answers. You're looking essentially at philosophy, philosophies of life, worldviews, and religions, because they are the ones that claim to have the biggest, most ultimate, and most comprehensive answers. And at the end of the day, there is no alternative but to look carefully in terms of what I called yesterday their adequacy. In other words, think where we moved. If someone has profound questions, triggered intellectually, triggered practically, triggered emotionally, triggered by some experience in their life. Some question has arisen in life, and now they're looking for answers. Well, there are certain things about this particular search. First, the search will be somewhat conceptual. Second, it'll be highly critical. Thirdly, it will be comparative. What do I mean? Conceptual in the sense that often the seeker is triggered by an experience. When they start searching, they send their minds out like a scout to look for possible answers, but there are many. And they don't commit themselves too easily, any more than you do when you're shopping. So the mind goes out looking like a scout for possibilities that will answer the question. And there's always that burning question. So this is the stage of the search that is rather more conceptual. Secondly, it's critical. Now you sit back and listen to me and you think, well, we can look at this answer, that answer, the other answer. We're looking at them, but we forget. When you commit yourself to that which you believe is adequate, in tomorrow's talk, true, when you commit yourself to that, you don't any longer just see it, you see by it. Because our world views are like lenses, as C.S. Lewis says, I believe in the Christian faith as I believe in the sun. Not just because I see the sun, but because I see everything else by the sun. Now that's terribly important. It means that the worldview, the philosophy of life, the religion you choose, whether secular, like naturalism, or transcendent, like Hinduism, Buddhism, the Christian faith, or Judaism, whatever the worldview is, it will shape the things you see, and also remember, it will shape the things you don't see. Now that point which philosophy has always remembered is heavily underscored today by brain research. It's the kind of attention we bring to what we experience and see that shapes the way we know reality. Take something very, very simple. A mountain. To a Greek pagan, it might be the dwelling place of the gods. To a Portuguese navigator, it could just be a landmark. To a South African mining engineer, potential wealth. To a French painter like Cézanne, a subject for his canvas. For a 19th century English climber, it represents the challenge to climb because it's there. And to today's extreme sportsman, it could be the supreme thrill and the ultimate risk. And so on. They're all seeing it differently. But here's the other point. The worldview you choose will not only see things differently, it will not see some things. Nietzsche was right here. He calls it the acoustic illusion. The idea, if we don't hear something, it's not there. Now we know very well that dogs and bats and bears hear things that we don't. I'm a tiny bit deaf. Speak up when you ask questions. I'm a tiny bit deaf. But it'd be crazy to think because we don't hear something, it isn't there. Now, one of the most sad things about secularists is that they're what Max Weber called tone deaf. They don't pick up the music by which most of the human world orchestrates its life. They don't get it. It's beyond the range of their thinking. They insist that certain things are true, that are scientifically verifiable, repeatable, and so on. Many of the deepest things of life, like love and other things, simply aren't. And many of the secularist people are tone deaf. One of the saddest things in the autobiography of Charles Darwin is his describing that as his naturalistic worldview came closer and closer, he says sadly he was no longer able to appreciate Handel's Messiah. He was tone deaf. And as Shakespeare said, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. So you've got to choose, knowing that certain philosophies see things, and certain philosophies just exclude them, and they don't see things at all. So it's critical that you choose wisely in terms of adequacy. The third thing, obviously, it's comparative. You look at all the different things. Now, some people immediately say, of course, there's far too many things to look at. I'd need 3 lifetimes and a millionaire's bank balance to look at all these things fairly. Well, there's 2 ways in which the search is narrowed in a focused way. First, each seeker has a particular question. You might theoretically ask 101 questions, but in fact, in most people's lives, there's one driving question, one burning issue, and that's what they want the answer to, and that narrows things enormously. But there's another source of the focus, too. While you could say theoretically, there are 1,001 philosophies of life in the world, for all practical purposes in our world today, there are 3 big families of faiths. That's the philosopher's word. Families, because certain philosophies have a common family resemblance, because they all go back to the same sense of the ultimate ground of reality. Now, when you see it that way, you're boiling it down essentially to the big 3. The Eastern religions, secularist faiths, and the Abrahamic faiths. Eastern religions all go back to the ultimate ground of being impersonal. The secularist worldviews all go back to chance. And the Abrahamic faiths all go back to an infinite but personal God. And the whole way they see the universe and the whole way we understand our human beings is different because of that. Now, there's all sorts of questions you could run through the lenses of those. And I would say to you, don't take my word for it, and certainly not since I've only got 5 minutes. Thank you, Mark. But don't take my word for a minute. You look for yourself. And what I'm saying to you right through this series, never take my word for it. Check it out for yourself. You read the stuff. You explore it for yourself and come to your own conclusions and your examined life. Now, I think it's Thursday, I want to pick up the great objection of them all, evil, suffering, which every worldview has to deal with. We'll leave that one aside for the moment. Let me very, very briefly pick up something incredibly important in the world today, our human dignity. What is it in the Eastern religions? I'm simplifying, forgive me. But they say, in essence, forget it. When we take ourselves seriously as individual people, we're being caught in the world of illusion or Maya. And our desire is binding us, and our craving and our attachment, and all this binds us to the wheel, and we go round and round and round. And freedom in both Hinduism and Buddhism is not freedom to be an individual. No. It's freedom from individuality, because individuality is the problem. Buddha, when he was enlightened in Bodhgaya, he didn't say, I am liberated. He said, it is liberated. He'd achieved what he called the not-self. His own son he called Rahula, fetter, ball and chain. Why? Relationships keep you back from that road to nirvana, and nirvana means the ultimate deathless lake of extinction. There's no high place for individual personality in the East. How about secularism? Secularism, to put it simply, and I'm quoting Bertrand Russell, says do it yourself. We come from chance, we're moving towards extinction, we live little brief lives, so each of us is to be like the Greek giant Atlas, who carried his own world on his own shoulders. Do it yourself. It's, as other philosophers say today, invented meaning. Do it yourself. Think it through for yourself. There's no meaning out there to be discovered in the universe. So any meaning you want is a self-created, invented meaning. And, of course, when you're young enough, wealthy enough, well-educated enough, Cambridge, etc., there's a time in your life when you think you can do that. And I know many people who are followers of Nietzsche and Ayn Rand and so on who try to live that way. Nietzsche said, you must so live that at the end you can say, thus I willed it. But that certainly isn't for most people. And it certainly isn't for most of life. And when you look at the great atheists themselves, it certainly wasn't true of Nietzsche himself, and you could go on. Individual dignity in the third worldview, the Abrahamics. Each person is understood as made in the image of God. So they have a precious, inalienable dignity. No wonder human rights came out of that. Why are humans special? Read Peter Singer, the animal rights man. He would say, when we say we're different and have human rights, we're suffering from species chauvinism, speciesism. And you can't find a high view, but in the Jewish and Christian view especially, you have a very high view of everyone. As I said yesterday, regardless of their education, regardless of their physical handicaps, regardless of their economic status, there is no one who's not loved by God and has a precious, inalienable dignity without exception. Again, you can take whatever question you like and just run it through each of those worldviews. And the issue, as I was saying yesterday, the issue at the second stage is adequacy. People with questions are looking for answers, and they're looking at worldviews and saying, does it throw light on my issue? Is it adequate as I look at it? Now, that's not the end of the game. Tomorrow we'll go on to the crucial question. Something might be incredibly adequate, throw amazing light, but be a fiction. The question, of course, is it true, and how can we be sure? But let me just finish quickly with this story. I don't know if you love G.K. Chesterton. One of his favorite stories that I love is a story about Cambridge, about a fictional college in Cambridge called Breakspear College. And in his story, Man Alive, the warden of Breakspear is the eminent professor of philosophy in Cambridge, and he's the world expert in the pessimistic philosophers like Schopenhauer. And one day, one of his brilliant students, who's listened to him, dazzled for a year, comes in to talk, and the warden is open to anyone any time of the day or the night, and they're talking all evening and going deeper and deeper into the thinking of Schopenhauer and others, and the professor is arguing, well, why doesn't God kill us, the student says, if life's that meaningless? And the professor says, well, God himself is dead, so he can't kill us. And it goes on like this. And suddenly, after midnight, the student whips out a revolver and points it at the professor and says, in effect, I'm going to take you at your word. You say life is pessimistic, there's no meaning, everything's despairing. It's merciful to put people in despair out of their misery. I'm going to do it to you. The professor leaps for the window and finds himself on a flying buttress outside the window. And the student waves the revolver at him, and they have this extraordinary discussion. And then, as the gray turns to pink and the dawn comes in Cambridge, and the beauty of this amazing town and university has shown up, the professor shouts out, let me back, I want to live. And with great delight, the student lets him back. It's a fascinating story. And you can see that Chesterton is saying bluntly, worldviews are very different, and the differences make a difference. And it's when they go to the very end and you see the full consistency of them that you see where they lead to. And I'll just finish with this thought. We're in a world, and certainly in a university, where anything is arguable. But while some things can be thought, they can't be lived. And that's the real test of adequacy and what you've got to choose.